Welcome to Everything STEAM. I'm your host, Sam Stanford. As a physicist and structural engineer with Jacobs Engineering, I've made many connections with some bright individuals who are either working, studying, or self-taught and passionate about our particular topics of discussion. When was the last time you thought about language, its flaws, and its importance in society? When was the last time you thought about how you would quench a moral dilemma? Or when was the last time you thought about having total control over your decisions versus having no control at all? Well, put your thinking caps on, because today's the day we revisit those topics. To properly visit these topics, I brought on someone who knows what they're talking about, because that person sure isn't me. Our guest not only holds depths in the realms of linguistics and philosophy, but also can deliver with a sense of humor. That guest is Mike Kaplan. Mike is a professional comedian with a background in linguistics and philosophy. He has appeared on The Tonight Show, Conan, Letterman, James Corden, Seth Meyers, Comedy Central, Last Comic Standing, and America's Got Talent. He has a half-hour special on Comedy Central, a one-hour stand-up special on Amazon called Small, Dork, and Handsome, and a new dry bar special called Live from the Universe, as well as two podcasts, The Faucet and Broccoli and Ice Cream. Another interesting thing about Mike is that his debut album, called Vegan Mind Meld, was one of iTunes' top 10 comedy albums of the year, and his newest album, AKA, debuted at number one and was called invigoratingly funny by the New York Times. So now that you've been briefly introduced to Mike and the topic of this podcast, we're going to head into the first segment where we plan to talk about the study of language and its structure, as well as how language impacts society at large. Cheers. Mike, welcome to the podcast. It's amazing that we finally are able to make this happen.
Very happy to be here. For the listener, of course, I'm here right now, and you don't know that we've been emailing about this for literally millions of years. So happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. We definitely started this in the Pleistocene, and we're getting to it now. So I learned about Mike through Matthew Broussard. After him and I did our recording a while back, he was like, hey, this is a list of people that you should try to get on your show. And Mike was one of them. And then, of course, Dr. Kevin Hickerson was another one. So I'm excited to make this happen. For this episode, it's definitely a mix-up from what normally goes on, because I don't have any background in what we're talking about today. So I'm going to be saying things that I Googled and that I've read in a book, you know, one book. So again, like, the Dunning-Kruger effect may be taken into account here, guys. So this is all about linguistics and philosophy. I mean, a very small portion of linguistics and a very small portion of philosophy. And we're catering the back half of this to philosophy of ethics. And then we'll have a slight discussion. I'm very excited to know what Mike has to say about free will versus determinism. I know it's a clickbaity topic conversation, but I feel like with his background and my background, there might be some different things that will come to the surface. But for this segment, we're going to be talking about linguistics. And I want to start off by asking Mike if he has heard of Ludwig Wittgenstein and his famous statements about the limits of language.
I definitely came across Wittgenstein in my studies in both philosophy and linguistics. So I got an undergraduate degree in philosophy and psychology and a minor in linguistics. And then I got a graduate degree, a master's degree in linguistics. And I think it was probably in my philosophy classes more than in my linguistics classes that Wittgenstein arose. Though I did take, there's like some overlap. Like, I took a philosophy of math class that was both a math class and a philosophy class. There was an intro to cognitive science class that was a psychology class and I think a linguistics class. And then there was definitely like a philosophy of language class, which was linguistics and philosophy. So I don't remember where I first came across Wittgenstein, but he was like, you know, one of the major like philosophy of language, like linguistic philosophy guys, however long ago that was. And I remember he talked a lot about games and like that in some ways, like everything is a game. I think, you know, that language is a game, communication is a game. And, you know, I'm out of my degree program for 15 years at least. So
don't date yourself, man.
I'm happy to be, you know, one time I was performing stand-up comedy at a college. I was doing some material about children and age and, you know, growth and learning. And I always like to ask people of all ages, like, how old they are and how old they wish they were. And I kind of had the idea that if they wished that they were the age that they were, I thought that was like the wisest answer, to be like, oh, to wish for what is, like, beautiful. But then this 19-year-old at a college once, he answered in a way that I was like, well, that one, that's good too. He was like, I wish I was 50. And I was like, wow, why? And he's like, he said, because I want to be wise. And I'm like, wow, this kid at 19, no, he's like, I'll probably I'll know more when I'm 50. And so I'm 44 now, and I'm very content to let people know how old I am, how long it's been since I've been in school, how long I've been since I've, you know, been learning the things that we're talking about. And also, while we were just talking, I was briefly finding the Wikipedia page for language game, in parentheses, philosophy. And it's just a brief quote. A language game is a philosophical concept developed by Ludwig Wittgenstein, referring to simple examples of language, language use, and the actions into which the language is woven. Feel free to read the rest of that Wikipedia page on your own. But short answer to your question is, yes, I'm familiar, at least broadly, with Wittgenstein.
Way better than I am. But I would say, I guess, I saw a common theme come up where he said that language exists for the purpose of communication and its function is to convey information. But information can be lost in language, in that transformation of information, but also the interpretation of reality, because we use words to describe it in one way, shape, or form, whether we're writing it down or just speaking about it, you know, freely. Things can be lost, and that has implications.
The very first paper that I had to write in a semantics class in my linguistics program was to define a chair. Like, what defines a chair? Like, what is the definition that captures everything that is a chair and nothing that isn't a chair? Because there are things that are very similar to chairs, like a couch is kind of like a chair, or a bench is kind of like a chair, or a stool is kind of like a chair, or like a high chair. Is a high chair a chair? Is a beanbag chair a chair? Yes, but it looks nothing like almost any other chair. So from our teacher's guidance, like, the combination of form and function that sort of makes a thing a thing. But also, like, we might look at the same thing and I'm like, that's a chair. And you might be like, no, that's, I think that's more of like a love seat or a bench. Or the more words you have for something, then perhaps the farther apart we might be in our understanding. Like, for a language that only has two color words, you're like, that one's dark, that one's light. And then if you add in, you know, dozens of other color words, you're like, oh, that one's magenta and that one's fuchsia, you know, and that one's teal and that one's puce. And then some people might just have, I got your basic six words. But one overall point, there's many points here, it's a multi-pointed point that I'm making. I would say that, like, the word chair isn't a chair. Like, a chair is a chair, and a thing is a thing, and words will almost never capture the thing that they're talking about. They'll only be like some sort of approximation. And like you said, you know, depending on people's sort of individual lexicons or languages of origin, you know, there are certain colors that if you look at it, like, somebody's like, that's definitely purple, and somebody else might be like, that's definitely blue. It doesn't mean that they don't know what the words mean, but they might have a slightly different wavelength associated with the color in their mind, or they might actually perceive color slightly differently. Obviously, some people are colorblind in various ways. So overall, And one other thing I mentioned to you before we started recording that I'll bring up now, there was a guy named Grice who came up with these maxims, the Gricean maxims. They're basically about communication and how language works. I think it's also called the cooperative principle. And so the four maxims are: one, the maxim of quantity, the maxim of quality, the maxim of relation, and the maxim of manner. And so basically, quantity is you try to be give as much information as needed, nothing more. There's like a webpage that has Grice's maxims that I always just Google Grice's maxims and it pops up. It's from UPenn. The maxim of quality is where one tries to be truthful and doesn't give like false information. And this is like the way that regular communication generally works. And then the maxim of relation, where what you're saying is hopefully relevant. And then the maxim of manner, where you try to be clear and brief and orderly. An example is like, let's say you said to me, is Dave home? Let's say we both know a guy named Dave. Like, you say, is Dave home? That probably means I know who Dave is. Like, you're being relevant, not giving more information than you need. If you were like, you know, Dave, our mutual friend who we both talk about every day, you're not going to say that necessarily, because if we both have the common referent of Dave in our experience, you're like, hey, is Dave home today? And then I might answer, well, I drove by and there is a green car outside his house. And that could be nonsense, or it could mean we both know that Dave has a green car, or it could mean that we both know that Dave's greatest enemy has a green car and is sitting outside of his home. Under ordinary conversational circumstances, it would be weird if it meant nothing. Right. And in comedy, I feel like often the Gricean maxims are sort of like bent and broken for comedic effect. A classic old joke, like, yeah, do you know this one? How many months have 28 days?
Oh, yeah, all of them.
Yeah, all of them. And like, obviously, in a regular conversation, if you say to somebody, hey, how many months have 28 days? They'd be like, one February, obviously. Doing it in a joke book, it's fun, but doing it in real life is jerky. So language, of course, exists, you know, first and foremost for communication. And then I feel like language is not only for the kind of communication that we think of as like communicating information, you know, like lyrics in a song communicate something, but they're not necessarily about how to do something or like, help me, like throw me a life preserver, you know, pull me out of this river. That's communication in one way compared to like, oh, this music really speaks to me is like communication in another way, though perhaps all communication in a way.
Yeah. I don't know why, but I just kept thinking like, this feels like along the lines of like the horrible conversation of like, is a hot dog a sandwich? It's that same dilemma.
I love it. I went on a podcast once called The Sporkful that a friend of mine, Dan Pashman, runs. And it's like, it's all like food related. And I went on to have discussions with him about, you know, is spaghetti with marinara sauce a salad? Is a taco a sandwich? You know, and he's like, you know, somebody's going to argue one, somebody's going to argue the other. The answer is it depends based on your definition. That's the interesting thing that can come out of this is like, of course it depends on your definition. And so if your definition is such that it rules in something that you don't want to rule in, then maybe you need to change your definition so that it doesn't, or maybe you can accept that at the fringes. I mean, of course, it's always going to be that at the fringes, like there'll be things that are in like the non-binary. Is this black? Is this white? Well, what about this one? Oh, there's some gray area in between, obviously. We know it with age. We're knowing it more these days with gender, with race, of course. Like it isn't just that there's absolute concrete, this is this and that is that. And so it's like sandwich, non-sandwich. Like, I feel like it'd be a funny image to imagine, like, definitely a sandwich, two pieces of bread and something in between. That's your classic archetype of sandwich. And then at the other end, you have like, you know, completely disparate, no bread at all. And just like things like strewn about like a deconstructed mess of garbage. But then you could create like an evolutionary, you know, trail between them and be like, oh, right in the middle, like maybe a taco's in the middle. Certainly a taco is more a sandwich than a salad that has no bread or starch or anything in it, right?
Yeah.
I had this woman on my podcast once whose name is Ashton Applewhite, and she is an anti-ageism activist. And she also created the Truly Tasteless Joke Books series from that I like grew up with in the 80s. She was the first person to like share with me this concept that now I'm like, of course, this makes complete sense that there is not just young and old. You know, when you're 5 years old, a 6 year old could be old. You know, when you're 10, a 20 year old, when you're 30, a 50 year old, whatever it is. And, you know, my mom, she's in her 70s now. And sometimes if somebody she knows dies at 83, she'll be like, so young. You know, it's, of course, relative. So it's not that ageism is discrimination against old people or young people. It's discrimination against the older or the younger, that it's relational, that it's older or younger. Like, you know, I believe that I'm older than you, you're younger than me, but it doesn't mean that you're young and I'm old, because those absolutes don't have any, you need somewhere to ground them. You know, how tall are you? Well, compared to a little dog or a mountain, you know, how fast are you going compared to a snail or compared to a comet, you know, or or light? This is all to say, are you more sandwichy or less sandwichy? And I would say that, yeah, a hot dog and taco are more sandwichy than some things and less sandwichy than you say, imagine a sandwich and people picture the platonic form of a sandwich. And they're like, well, a hot dog isn't that, but less sandwich than that.
Yeah.
If you make an artificial, you have to say yes or no, this or that, which one is it? Then that is where it can become irritating.
Understood. Two great points, I think. One, words are used with like the relativity of wrong. And then also, I think it's like based on the conversation. If we're having the conversation, the philosophical conversation of what is a sandwich, fine. You know, the spectrum can be pretty broad. But like, if I'm just trying to order a hot dog at the store, I'm not going to go, hey, man, can you get me a sandwich? I want a hot dog. You know, like it's definitely circumstantial, you know?
Absolutely.
Yeah. There's a bit of reductionism in this where it's like, it makes sense to be binary in certain situations. But then there are certain situations that it's like, it's okay to like discuss on a spectrum or like have a word lie on a spectrum.
Yeah. I think this also came up in one of my linguistics classes. Like some public parks might have a sign up that says no motorized vehicles, right? They don't want motorized vehicles in there. And then somebody's like, what about a motorized wheelchair? Is that technically is a motorized wheelchair? And they're like, we're okay with wheelchairs. If your wheelchair is motorized, that's, we just don't want like kids on like, you know, motorized scooters zooming through. We want motorcycles. We don't want cars driving through. And so like the intent is important, like the spirit of the law more than the letter of the law. Though of course, linguistics, I feel like, is about examining the spirit and the letter of the law and how can hopefully, you know, the letter support the spirit and maybe vice versa.
That makes total sense. So I think we've really built up to this point. And I think it would be good if I just got like an overview. Give me the 5-minute version of what you think linguistics breaks down into.
Sure, of course. The very first linguistics class that I took, I always forget whether it was called like the grammar of English or the structure of grammar. And so I'll start by talking about what linguistics isn't. It is the study of language. What does that mean? I remember I fell in love with it because my professor, Joan Mailing, one of the first things she said was, she's like, I don't care if you split infinitives. I don't care if you use preposition at the end of a sentence. I don't care if you say ain't or spell things wrong. It's like, that's not what linguistics is concerned with. It's not concerned with prescribing how people should speak. It's about describing how people do speak. And that breaks down into like the various classes that I took, sort of your core classes that everyone who studied linguistics at Boston University, where I got my master's degree, like studied. Like you had your basic classes were, well, what is language? At the very root of it, it's made of sounds. My first one basic class was called like phonetics and phonology. So phonetics is like the study of the actual like acoustics of like the sounds that are being produced by, if it's a spoken language, the mouth, you know? So we studied, you know, how are these sounds made? You know, what sounds exist in what languages? You know, some languages have a th, some languages don't. English is one of the only ones with a th, which is why sometimes, you know, if the classic, you know, stereotype of a French accent is like this or that, you know, because they don't have a th in their language. And then in our language, we have one B sound and one P sound. And I believe in Korean, they have like multiple Bs. They have like one that could be like breath or voiced and one that's not voiced or one that's aspirated or one that's not aspirated. And so there's all these different ways that the sounds can be manifested. And that's phonetics. And then phonology is like sort of the study of that. For every phone or sound that comes out of our mouth, there's some phoneme in our head. And that is like our, you know, mental representation of the sound. So like in actuality, here's an interesting thing. The word pit and spit, one is P-I-T, one is S-P-I-T. It seems like it's the same P. It is the same P phoneme-wise, I believe. In our head, we're like, that's a P. But as it comes out, it's a different phone. Because if you think about spit, and then if you take the S off of it, and you can do this like, you know, electronically, you could say record yourself saying the word spit. It actually turns out that it's more spit. The P in spit is more like our B in bit. It's more spit and not spit. Because we're not saying like pit is aspirated, I believe. And so different levels of like, you know, sort of you learn like Freud when you start learning about psychology and you're like, okay, this is what he said. And like, and here's everything he got wrong. And then with linguistics, you're like, here's what Chomsky said, you know, sort of like the Freud of linguistics. And like, and here's everything he got wrong. And like, you start with noun phrases, then you're like, it's actually a determiner phrase, whatever it is. But so on one level, pit is aspirated. We're like, pit. And bit is not aspirated, bit. And then so spit has S and then the non-aspirated bit, but we think of it as a P because we spell it with a P, but that's just something that happens between our brain and it coming out of our mouth because maybe it's harder for us to say spit. Like that's weird to take a stop and make that aspirated. So that's like the interaction of phonetics and phonology. And like, for example, in certain Asian languages, we think of sometimes the R and the L sound, when we might say an R, they say an L, or vice versa. And the reason for that is, in some languages, the R and the L are two different phonetic manifestations of one phoneme. There's one phoneme in their head that's like, sometimes it comes out as R, sometimes it comes out as L. And so it just happens systematically. Same thing for us. If we were trying to pronounce a Korean word with sounds that don't exist in our native language, we would sound to them like they sound to us, for example. That's phonetics and phonology. Then those sounds, mm-hmm. you know, combine into meaningful units that are called, I didn't come up with the name, morphemes is sort of the next level. And so the study of morphology, which is kind of the only, like, of those words, we're familiar with phonetics. There's going to be four different levels, and all of them are words that are generally, I think, you know, colloquially used, except for morphemes are not like a thing that we have a concept for. But it's not that they just combine into words, because sometimes a morpheme is a word, like dog is a morpheme and dog is a word. Doghouse is a word made of two morphemes, dog and house. And house, of course, can be its own word. Sometimes there are morphemes that cannot exist on their own outside of a word, like adverbial endings, like dash ly is a morpheme, or ing is a morpheme, but it's not a full word. Or even like cran, like maybe is cran a word? We can get to like the sandwich question, like cranberry is a word made of the morphemes cran and berry. And so a morpheme is the smallest meaningful unit of language. Mm-hmm. Like even phonemes or phones could seem like they have meaning, because like there's some words like, I don't know, snooze and schnoz and sneeze. I'm like, oh, does snuh? They all have something to do with the nose. Like, does snuh mean nose? Maybe, kind of. But I wouldn't say that snuh is itself a morpheme, but maybe that's a question that's been researched more since I left my degree program. But definitely the smallest unit that could sort of, you know, exist and be recognizable as meaningful, that is a morpheme. And then morphemes combine into words, or are words themselves. And then those words combine into sentences. And then the next level up is syntax, where, like, you know, when I was in second grade, I remember learning how to like diagram sentences for the first time. And I was like, this really speaks to me. Like, for whatever reason, like, I have a math brain, and like the math of English, that is what linguistics, or some parts of linguistics, are. And so, you know, you learn in syntax the way that different languages order sentences, order words. Like, I think for every sentence in most languages, there's going to be some either explicit or implicit subject, verb, and possibly object. And in English, the order usually goes subject, verb, object. You know, the person does the thing. So there's subject, verb, object, and then there's six possibilities for the order that could happen with SVO. And I think there's only one that's very uncommon. I forget which one it is, but it's like maybe one of the ones starting with object for whatever reason. Like, it might be object, verb, subject, or object, subject, verb. I forget which, but one of them is like not super common, but all the other ones kind of like exist in reasonable proportion. Like, there's no reason why any one of them is any more effective or efficient than any others. You learn what the people speak around you, and you're like, oh, that's what we do. The subject goes here, the verb goes here, the object goes here. And then the final level above that, I would say, is semantics, which is where basically you could have a sentence and what does it mean? Semantics is where sort of like meaning is gleaned, because you could have the same exact sentence, but with a different tone or with a different context, it might not mean the same thing. Even without a question mark at the end, you know, like going to the pool, the same words, the same syntax, like the same subject, object, verb relation. Sometimes speaking informally might be different than, you know, if you wrote it down. But, and also I'll just throw in a brief plug for, I believe her name is Gretchen McCulloch, is a linguist who wrote a book called Because Internet. And it involves lots of analyses of the way that these days, like, this is the first time in history that we have such a trove of examples of not only like formal writing, formal language, formal speech, which is like, you know, from the time of Shakespeare, from the time of Chaucer and Old English and any language, most mm-hmm. of the records that we have going back hundreds of years are from, like, you know, their church documents, or their like formal, like the Constitution or the Magna Carta, you know, only the things that very few people knew how to read for a long time. So mm-hmm. there wasn't a lot of, like, you know, there weren't a lot of postcards going back. And even today, now we've got, you know, examples of like texts, you know, and G-chats, and there's so much data that exists. So people can now like analyze, you know, the informal language, and because that's most of what language is informal language. Most of language is spoken, not written. Most of language is, you know, verbal communication. And that's something that we don't have access to cross-culturally going back too far. I would say those are the basics building blocks of linguistics, are like phonetics, phonology, morphology, syntax, semantics. And then, of course, on top of that, there's many other, like there's sociolinguistics, there's historical linguistics, there's, you know, other classes and focuses that people can have. But that was sort of the basics from my studies.
Wow. Okay. Two things, though. If you're not bilingual or you don't study other languages, or say you might not even read like manga for some reason, you won't know that like the structure of sentences changes based on different languages.
Yes.
Like, for example, the way that like Japanese versus like English is structured is completely different. But yes, like you said, it's just based on those like six available configurations.
Configurations.
Now that's really cool. And I can't really add any more on there because, like I said, then it'll be like the Dunning-Kruger effect and I'll just have to show myself out. But no, that's cool. So with all that being said, we've kind of played around with the fact that language does carry a sense of information can be lost, and it is based on, you know, interpretation, and there's a relativity of wrong in terms of, you know, who you're communicating with, etc. So what are some possibilities? What are some problems that could arise because of the faults in language?
I guess I'll start by answering the first question that you edited briefly mid question. Why does it matter? I mean, I do feel like the question of why it matters, like, you know, why does anything matter? Again, it's sort of context and definition dependent, but like any, you know, any scientific or social scientific examination, like, I mean, language is one of the, you know, the main things. Like I used to have a joke where I would say language is the only thing that separates us from the mimes, but you know, we're the only beings that communicate the way that we do. Of course, we're learning more now, actually, and AI, I think, is helping like learn to decipher, you know, dolphin or whale communications and bees and such as well. So obviously other animals are communicating, but without comparing ourselves to other creatures, language really helped advance social evolution when you could communicate with somebody, you know, when you're going out, I don't know, trying to take down a woolly mammoth, or like having more than just grunts, more than just looks, more than just, you know, nonverbal communication. Like that was something, and, you know, having words to identify, like, hey, that one's poisonous, you know, like, don't eat that one, you know, like, rather than just like, ah, you know, or whatever people were doing before language existed. They probably had ways, but so I think that, you know, the study of how that all happens, like, how does this mechanism work? How did we acquire it? Like, what is language? And so, yeah, I mean, I feel like it's fascinating. And even on like on a theoretical, on a philosophical level, but then also on a practical level, while I was in grad school, I worked at a technology company. I worked in the speech and language department, and we were training robots how to process language, like training computer models to understand what names were, what questions were, what things were. So sorry, everybody. It wasn't all my fault. So I feel like that is something that, you know, now there is like voice recognition technology that is much more advanced than it used to be. And, you know, obviously for better or worse, like tools online that help us answer questions or learn things and, you know, connect us to other people, to do translation with people like who don't speak the same language that we do. And I guess probably that's getting into like the challenges that are offered, as you were leaning towards as well.
Yeah, but I think I can also intervene and say, like,
please.
And you definitely were getting there. It's like today, more than even like in the past where we were just in hunter-gatherer tribes, we're mixing cultures and having to collaborate. Like our best work is done whenever we collaborate with other people that look at things through a different lens. And studying linguistics and understanding linguistics is such a big thing for us. We have to have that in society. That way we can kind of have a mesh and collaborate and also just understand other people and where they're coming from.
Absolutely. Every once in a while, you see like a listicle online that's like, look at these 14 words that don't exist in English, but that really speak to a resonant concept in people's, like, why don't we have these words, like wabi-sabi, you know, or like a word that talks about, I don't know, buying books, but not reading them. These resonant ideas that, of course, like we grow up with only our own conscious experience that we're directly knowing, but then we can listen to other people who have grown up in different circumstances, people of different ages, people of different, you know, obviously cultures, and then people who, you know, grew up completely with different languages. Have you heard of the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis?
No.
So did you see the movie Arrival?
Yes.
So the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis is at play in the movie Arrival in a way that, in my recollection of like learning about it in my linguistic studies, the basic hypothesis was like that if you have a word for something, then you see it more than if you don't, or you experience it more than if you don't. And if you don't have a word for it, like the idea that certain languages only have very few color words. Some only have two color words. And so the Sapir-Whorf hypothesis hypothesizes like maybe they don't see color the same way that other people who have more words for colors see color. I think that that theory has been like debunked in its, you know, sort of extreme form, that to say like, just because if I have, you know, some language has, you know, multiple words for like red, pink, purple, you know, somewhere along that spectrum, and we only have one or two of those words, like I think the human eye can still differentiate and be like, well, that's a lighter pink, that's a darker pink. You know, yeah. We have hundreds of thousands of shades that we can identify that we don't have words for all of them, but it gets to be like, that one's lighter, that one's darker. These are different if we look at them side by side.
Yeah, but it could be that that culture just really doesn't care about describing colors via words. And yet maybe compared to the culture that you were raised in, they care more about something that you care less of. If you consider that theory as being credible, it could be a slippery slope for many reasons.
Absolutely. And so I have a friend who is a comedian named Erin Judge, very dear friend. One of her earliest jokes that she would tell, she would say, "I'm bisexual," which for those that don't know means you're my type. And I mean, even the word bisexual itself has come to potentially mean different things when, it, you know, because bisexual sort of originally, I think, depended on the gender binary to be like, oh, I like this gender and that gender. Though nowadays, some people might interpret it to mean, oh, I'm attracted to my gender and genders that are not mine. And so it could be like bisexual could be a synonym for pansexual. Just I'm open to any gender. And so my friend Erin told me very specifically once, she was like, the idea of being attracted to different genders wasn't even how she like initially, like if she came up with the language, it might have been different. Cause she's like, I might be attracted to people of different cultures, people of different races, people of different ages, but I don't have a word for my identity that says, oh yeah, I'm attracted to this kind of person and that kind of person, this kind of person and that kind of person. And she's like, for gender, it's kind of like that for me. I'm like, gender just like isn't one of the filters through which she looks at people to assess whether she's attracted to them. And so I feel like, you know, if she had a society built around that concept, then, you know, the concept of the language of gender identity or of sexual orientation might have arisen in a different way. And perhaps there are other cultures that wherein it does arise in different ways. I haven't fully researched it.
That's interesting. And also, I do want to say that what you poked at there a little bit ago is that there's the aspect of where or like your social implications of how it builds your knowledge, I guess, in your own language. But then also, it's like the mind-body problem isn't really a thing. It's been debunked more for like the genetic / social implication of things. And, you know, with the way that we formalize how we communicate, heavily relies on both of those aspects and your social implications. It plays a huge role, you know, where Absolutely. You grow up, who you have friends with, who you talk to, you know, do you go to university? Do you travel? Are you in an open family? All those things matters in how you interpret language.
Yeah. And there's like a famous study that talks about sort of how class and language interact, where I think it was, you know, maybe the 60s, give or take a decade. I'm not positive when it was, but it's like a famous study that I believe people went into three different department stores of varying like expense level. Like I think at the high end store they went into was maybe Saks Fifth Avenue. The mid range was maybe Macy's. And then, you know, that kind of department store, and the lower price point end was Woolworth's. And they went in and these were all like, you know, big department stores. The experimenters would find people and ask them, hey, where can I find this item? And they would always ask for something that was found on the fourth floor. and they were basically essentially testing how people pronounced fourth floor. And I believe they found that, you know, when the price point was lower, people were less likely to say, to pronounce the R. The idea that, like, they would say, like, fourth floor, you know, in a way that if you're at Saks Fifth Avenue, they would enunciate the R very meticulously, the big fourth floor. Sometimes I think even if they would, they're like, oh, could you say that again? Or say, what was that again? And then if they asked a second time, then the people at Woolworths would be more likely to be like, oh, the fourth floor. Like, they would enunciate it more, but like sort of their natural pronunciation of it was fourth floor, which is sometimes in America seen as like a lower class. Like, there might be like judgments associated with the way that a person speaks, like whether it's, you know, a certain kind of New York accent or a Boston accent. But it's interesting because in one way, because like it's also very similar to a British accent that we might view as posh and elegant, be like, oh, the fourth floor, you know, like phonetically, acoustically, like it could be identical, yet based on the social context, that that accent might be seen like one way as like lower class in the United States versus higher class in the UK. And it's hard to even, you know, sometimes to speak about these concepts, like low class itself sort of has connotations of judgment, you know, which I think is sort of baked into our capitalistic society. The idea that, you know, that more money is better, that, and that, that, that there can be some, you know, ethical assessment of like that it's somehow that if you don't have more money, then it is your fault somehow, that you should have, that you didn't do the right thing, that, which is, you know, nonsense, because so many things are based on, you know, so many people who are millionaires like started that way, and so many people who don't started that way, and like there's an unfair playing field. And of course there are anomalous stories of people beginning their life with little money and ending it with lots of money. But I feel like empirically, that is not the standard experience across the board.
No, they also need to read The Great Gatsby, just saying.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So there's this bias, right? I mean, that's what I'm getting out of this. There's there's an unfortunate language bias. How do we break that? I mean, obviously studying linguistics.
Yeah, I think studying is an important thing. I mean, interrogating our own experience, like on an individual level, questioning like what we believe and why we believe it. And, you know, and I think the answer is you sort of alluded to it or directly stated it earlier. It's learning from people who are different than us, learning about other people's experiences. Like my parents were teachers. I would say we were middle class, you know, in a it's also really interesting when I was just in the UK for the Edinburgh Fringe Fest, and I was in Scotland for a month and in England for a week or two before that. And class is such an interesting topic over there, like that I think is more overtly discussed. And maybe it's because where we have a racial caste system, you know, historically, like maybe they have a class-based caste system. Mm-hmm. And I'm, you know, I'm certainly not an expert in this, but I remember when I'm there, they speak about class like much more than they speak about like religion or other topics that are like much more commonly discussed here. But so this is all to say, when I started doing comedy, I remember, so I was raised in New Jersey outside of New York City by like a half hour, an hour. And we didn't have a mansion, but we also, I never went hungry. And I remember, and everyone that I went to like high school with, I would say the majority of people went to college. That was just one of the parts of the culture that I was raised in. That's what you do. You go to high school, you go to college, you get a job, you have family, you die, whatever. And that's an important part of it. And I remember when I started doing comedy, I started meeting people who like didn't go to college, didn't graduate college, maybe didn't graduate high school. I don't know, people like Doug Stanhope, who I think is a genius comedian, like didn't have the same level of education that I think he might, I don't know if he, I actually don't know what level he made to beyond high school, if that. George Carlin, I feel like one of the smartest humans, one of the smartest comedians for sure. Similarly, like school-based education wasn't the thing that made him who he was. And so I remember meeting people who I thought were like super smart comedians. Their family, their culture, their wherever they grew up, like they individually didn't have the same parameters as my family did, as my where I grew up did. And so that was like super illuminating, because I was like, wait, but I thought don't smart, you know, on a very, very reductive way. I was like, don't smart people go to college? Like, isn't that what they do? And like, eventually I was like, man, if I knew that I wanted to be a comedian before I went to college, I could have saved a lot of money. And that's what a lot of my friends who didn't go to college, they're like, oh, I want to be a comedian. I'm going to go to a city, start doing open mics and start really like living the life of my dreams without, I mean, I loved my college experience. I loved learning everything that I did. But, you know, I also think about that the scene in Good Will Hunting where he talks, you know, to the Harvard guy about how you could get that same education. You know, like the books exist, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. especially today, the information, the internet,
yeah.
so much of it is out there. And so that was like a real paradigm shift for me was, you know, meeting people of different cultural, educational, class backgrounds. So, I mean, that's certainly something that I don't know if there's one size fits all answer to how can we, you know, eliminate our biases, but certainly meeting people or reading books by or taking in the art of like human mm-hmm. beings who, you know, if you were born in America, you know, learn about the immigrant experience. If you were, you know, but you can always learn from people who are older than you or younger than you or, you know, who grew up in a different place or who speak a different way. And to know that, obviously, like if somebody speaks with a strong accent, it doesn't mean, I mean, number one, if somebody comes to the States, like there's a comedian named Joe Wong who started out around when I did, and he's so funny and brilliant. And he had a very, you know, he was born in China. He had a very strong accent that he spoke English with. And also like, how good is my Chinese? How good is my Mandarin or Cantonese? Like, I mean, yeah. he does comedy now in both languages. He's fluent in English and in his native language. And I feel like, you know, that there's so many like context-based judgments that until we explicitly think about them and look at them, you know, we're mm-hmm. like, you know, the idea of the bigot who's like, you're going to come here, learn English. I'm like, so many people do come here, do learn English and also can converse with, you know, so many more people around the world and learn so many. There's so much mm-hmm. we can learn from people who speak more languages than we do.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. And just a quick testimony, I guess, before we run out of this segment, because I thought it'd be fun to add it. So I'm sure most of the listeners know that I'm actually living in Tel Aviv, Israel. And there's a lot of positives to living here. But one that I would probably rank the highest is being able to communicate with people who speak in different languages. Like in the team of structural engineers that we have, all of them speak three languages, I'm pretty sure. Between French, Arabic, Hebrew, English, Portuguese. Yeah, so like it's a mix and it's impressive. But one of the fun challenges that separates itself from the other like benefits of living here is the fact that like whenever we're trying to perform these tasks, they'll come to me and be like, Sam, check my English, or what does this mean? Or should I use this word? And in my life, I have never had to do that outside of like an English course. So it's like, you know, I've never really thought about why I say this word, you know, like, why do I use this syntax? Why is the semantics this way? And it's really cool. And it like kind of brings the whole full circle of like just like common education in the United States. And then also the beauty of just being submersed with people that are completely different from you. So it's a cool perspective. And I think everyone should at least try to converse with people who aren't, you know, just speaking English. Go out and speak with someone else. It's fun.
Yeah. I mean, of course, like learning another language, learning anything, you know, learn on your own, learn with other people, like do what you can and do what you want.
Yeah, absolutely. So whenever we come back, we're going to, I think, mash our ethics conversation and then we'll get out of here. So stick around.
Have you ever been standing in the shower, looking at the ingredients on your shampoo bottle, and noticed that water is always the first ingredient? Well, I have. After a little research, I discovered that shampoo is over 80% water, which is kind of like dumping bottled water on your head while you're standing in the shower. And that's why I'm excited that I found Seabar, a disposable plastic-free hair care line that cleans up ocean trash with every purchase. Not only does Seabar pick up 1 pound of ocean trash for every item ordered, but their salon quality shampoo and conditioner concentrates come from refillable applicators, kind of like deodorant tubes. Just twist them up, rub it on over your hair a couple times, and then just lather it up like you normally would. My favorite part is how long they last. I've personally been using the same Seabar for 3 months now, and I've barely used any. So not only does it help save the environment, it's also effective, efficient, and most importantly, it saves me money.
If you would like to try a better way to wash your hair, head on over to CBAR.com and use our special code STEAM for 15% off your first order.
CBAR, shampoo done right for you and the planet.
All right, we're back, and this is going to be a condensed version of the podcast just because the first segment kind of ran a little longer than we expected, and honestly, it was great. I thought it was a good back and forth, and Mike did a fantastic job explaining things.
Thank you.
I don't have to say much, that means the guest is doing an awesome job. So it's also the fact that I don't know what I'm talking about, and I'm okay with saying that.
Can it be both? Thank you for listening, everyone. Yeah.
So for segment two, what we talked about offset is we're going to shrink down the whole philosophy of ethics. We were going to cover a lot of schools of thought, but we felt like if we were just going to discuss the dilemmas that are kind of open-ended still in ethical philosophy, then we would end up inevitably talking about some of the schools of thought. So we're just going to do it that way.
Just briefly, the two main schools of thought that I learned about in my first ethics classes were utilitarianism and Kantianism is what I learned, sort of calling it utilitarian. We've all heard of it for the most part, doing the most good for the most people, just having the best consequences. And then Kant, weird that consequences sort of starts with Kant, consequences. Mm-hmm. Now for the Kant sequences, he was basically like, no, you don't want to think about the outcome. You want to think about the action and make sure the action is something that you'd like will everyone to do. Because sometimes if everyone just does the other thing, then he's like, then there'd be chaos. And so I feel like that brief summation is in a utilitarian way helpful to decrease the suffering and increase the joy for all of our listeners.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's all sorts of fun stipulations out there with the rules of thought. And it's fun because whenever you just like read different like scripts from philosophers in the past, they'll beat up like stoicism. And then they'll be like, well, I live in the camp of consequentialism and I'm a utilitarianist, you know, it's like, but then there's holes in that one too. It's just subjective views, of course. But yes, so whenever we get through the open-ended dilemmas, we'll then have a quick discussion as quick as Mike would want about determinism versus free will. So that'll be fun. So let's dive into it. The first one that we have on the list is the trolley problem. I'll briefly define it and then I'll hand it over to Mike. So the trolley problem is that you're conducting a train and you're heading along a track and something bad happens. Inevitably, there's a split in the rail. And if you were to continue straight, you would kill 5 railway workers. And then there's the split that you could potentially change to the other track, the other lane, and kill only 1 rail worker. So, Mike, do you want to expand on that?
Yeah, I think the idea is that, you know, obviously on a utilitarian level, it seems like killing one person dying is better than 5 people dying. But part of the, I think, trick of the problem is that in order to have that better option, you have to take action. Would you rather actively cause 1 death or passively allow 5 deaths? A lot of people are like, we should definitely do the one death. And obviously, as a, you know, we're just talking about it. Glad we're not. I have a joke about how I am vegan. Look how long I went without telling you. Though I might have already, but no. Sometimes people become vegan for different reasons. Some people are like, maybe it's healthier for me. You know, people are like, I'm going to live a more plant-filled, vegetable-filled life. Some people are like, I'm thinking about the environment, like the planet. If many more people became plant-based eaters, like then the resources that are going into cattle would be more suitably put. The carbon footprint would vastly decrease. And so yeah. If you care about the whole planet, you're like, well, that's a reason to become vegan as well. And then, I mean, the reason that I became vegan was when I learned more about, you know, factory farms and the way that animals are treated. And it's horrendous. And even, you know, even if animals are treated nicely, which mostly they're not, like most of the animals in the, you know, the meat system, the dairy system these days, there's a bunch of unnecessary suffering. And I'm like, I'd rather not be a part of as much unnecessary suffering as I can. That is my care for the animals. So in a way, I feel like there's a trolley problem where we're on a track heading for all of the animals, the entire planet, and our own health, potentially. We're like, we're on the track. The animals are on the track. The whole world is on the track. And we're like, well, what would you rather do? Should we keep it heading towards that track? Or should we become vegan and turn the track towards, oh, nobody gets killed over here? Obviously, there's still, you know, pain and suffering that exist in the world. But people are like, if we keep going this way, I still get cheese. Anyway, so that's, I think, you know, a vegan update of the trolley problem. But here's something that I heard years ago, like, because it seems obvious if you're like just on a numbers basis, if you're going by numbers, only have one person die, don't have five people die. But then you could ask this question. If a healthy person walks into a doctor's office and they have two kidneys, two lungs, and a heart that there's five people waiting for, somebody's waiting for a kidney, they'll die without it. Somebody's waiting for a heart, they'll die without it. Somebody's waiting for the other kidney, then the two lungs. And they're like, well, is it not the same calculus to passively let five people die or actively cause one death so that those other five people could live? And that is, I think, a much more compelling tweak to the trolley problem, where for anyone who said cause the one death, save the five, I feel like many people would change their tune, because it's not only, you know, a logical calculus. There's also this, what society do we want to live in? And perhaps that does, you know, shift us back and forth between the pure extreme utilitarian view and the more Kantian view. It's so interesting because they're both thought experiments. Neither of them are actually happening to me right now. I'm not in charge of who lives and dies in this way, thankfully. But, you know, I feel more comfortable. It seems more removed, like a trolley. Yeah. Trolley the one person. Save those five, tra-la-la-la-la, you know, we did it. But to even say like, yeah, I mean, it's hard to imagine wanting to live in a society where like, if you're healthy and you go to the doctor, they could be like, we need your organs now. Here's the thing is there's so many implications then like, okay, well then maybe that healthy people would stop going to the doctor and then people would die sooner because they're not found, you know, like diseases aren't found and like society could crumble in that way. So yeah, I think that manifestation of the trolley problem really gets to like the intent of it. I mean, we live in a society with laws. What do we want those laws to be? Like, I read a book by Peter Singer, who was one of the first ethical philosophers I was familiar with, who wrote Animal Liberation and books about rethinking life and death, about euthanasia and abortion and all kinds of things. And he had this one book about effective altruism. I think it's called like The Most Good You Can Do. And, you know, it starts with a story about, if you're walking near a pond and you see a child drowning in it and you're the only one around, you'll probably run in the pond and save that drowning child, even if it ruins your clothes that cost hundreds of dollars. And yet also there's children dying all over the world that hundreds of dollars would help not die. And we don't take that action because when it's in front of our face, it seems more immediate. And in that book, he talks about how Austria and Germany are two very similar civilizations, similar societies. In our system, in America, organ donation is opt-in. Like, you know, you get a driver's license, they're like, do you want to be an organ donor? You can say yes or no. The default is you're not. And you have to choose to be like, yes, I would like to donate my organs. In Germany and Austria, I forget which is which, or whatever the countries are that he talked about, one country is opt-in and the other is opt-out. In both cases, people go with the default 70% of the time. So in the one where it's opt-in, people mostly aren't organ donors. 30% of people are like, yeah, I think that would be a good thing to do. But in the one where it's opt-out, people are like, yeah, what we do here, we're organ donors. You know, that's what we do. And if some people are like, nah, I don't want you to have my organs, that's fine. That's allowed. But it's such an interesting thing because why wouldn't it be even if people are making like the rational, logical choice of like, is it good or is it bad? Is it, do I want it or do I not want it? Clearly, the cultural context of where you're starting from is very relevant. And so this is all to say, I think we all should be organ donors wherever you live. Yeah. I think that would be a good thing. And it's funny because sometimes people then worry, they're like, well, what if I get into an accident and the doctor sees that I'm an organ donor? Will they try to save me less? Like, and it becomes like, you know, another morphing of that. I feel like there are people who worry. They're like, if there's me and another guy and they could save me or him, and, you know, and these kind of, you know, like ticking bomb kind of type, you know, thought experiments arise. I'm like, good news, most of us are not going to be in any of these like worst case scenario situations, but it is a good thought experiment to think like, you know, the question is like, how do we want to live our life it's sort of like the wave particle duality. Like, you know, we are both. Every individual situation we're in is our life. And also, like, what kind of society do we live in? Utilitarian is like, what's the best thing for this moment right now? What can we foresee? What consequences from this action? And then Kant is like, what can we foresee if everyone did the action that you're talking about? And then trying to game it. And, you know, we're flawed, imperfect beings that don't have complete foresight. We don't know what's going to happen tomorrow, but we do our best to figure out, like, what's the best thing I can do right now? That also hopefully would be the best if everyone, if every reasonable person did this as well. And I think it's, yeah, run over the one guy, but don't kill the guy at the doctor.
Yeah. And there's a couple other ways that you can take this other than just like the Kantism and utilitarianism. Is like, obviously you can take it as relativism, where everyone has their own subjective view and will probably do what they feel is right and wrong with social or societal implications to that. Then there's also the objectivism, where you could just take the stance of, well, I'm going to go with whatever is naturally right. No matter what the divine or the individual tells me, whatever happens is the right course of action. To me, it feels almost like a naturalist way of thinking. It's like, well, whatever nature's intending.
That also, I feel like, edges into the determinism versus free will discussion, because like, whatever nature wants or intends, like, we're part of nature. So I feel like that is also sort of like, you know, if you believe that in any context there is personal responsibility, then I think that that's a bit of a cop out.
It is a cop out, just so they don't have to think about it after it happens. It also kind of ties in with what I'm about to say. Is it's like, well, let's just say you're looking out for number one, and you're like, well, if I don't touch the lever to change to hit that one person, I never made that conscious decision to kill that one person. And also, if for some reason I am asked in a court of law, I never changed anything to make that person die. Mm-hmm. You know, what happened, I can say, well, I was in the back and I didn't see what happened till after the fact. But it's like, there's like some denialism going on there.
Oh yeah. You know, I don't mean to get us too far afield, but I have a good friend who's a practicing Buddhist. And so I've been learning a lot about Buddhism and I like it a lot. One of the main tenets, one of the main ideas in Buddhism is that most Buddhists would say that the goal is the increase of happiness and the roots of happiness and the decrease of suffering and the roots of suffering for all sentient beings. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, most people want on an individual level. And that's what most beings want, that for themselves. And then as you hopefully expand that zone of being like, oh, yeah, it'd be less suffering, more happiness for all. Absolutely. Mm-hmm. They don't have 10 commandments, but they do have 10 things that are like kind of equivalent. Like they're like, you know, suggestions. They would commend you but the cool thing about them is that for each one that they're like, don't do this, there are two positive things you can do. So for example, killing is a don't. We'd say, if you ask us, don't kill. But two positive things that you can do, and maybe one is more neutral, but one is not killing. Not killing is a good thing to do. Killing mm-hmm. is bad, not killing is good. What's the second thing that you can do that's even better than not killing is helping live, you know, feeding someone, giving someone medicine. And so I feel like in that example where the person is like, you know, covering their ass to be like, look, I don't know. I didn't see the thing. I didn't do anything. Yeah, you didn't kill anyone, but you also didn't do the best version of the thing that you could have done, which was to help live. Though also in Buddhist terms, I think if you did divert it such that you took action to save 5 lives and you took action to end 1 life, and you would also then, I think, technically speaking, acquire a karma of killing. But I think that there would be like, you know, it's kind of an asterisk of understanding that like there's a story of like the Buddha in one of his previous lives before he was fully awake, that he was on a ship or something and he knew that somebody was going to kill someone else, and he killed that person before they could kill, in part to save the person's life, but also to save the would-be killer from becoming a killer and acquiring that karma. And I think the story was that the Buddha then, his next life, he was a hell being, but only for a moment. He was like in hell, but then bounced back and then had another human life at some point, and then eventually, you know, fully woke.
But, interesting.
Yeah. So yeah, absolutely. There are many filters.
That's exactly why it's still open-ended. And we didn't even talk about like the divine command school of thought, where it's like your God or gods tells you not to kill, and such that, well,
I can't touch that lever potentially. There's like a weird conundrum here. It's like, you can't touch the lever to kill the person, but yet you still know that you're killing five people. So like, did your conscious choice to not turn the lever end up killing the five people? You know, like, cause you're still going to end up killing.
Well,
essentially, and you're aware of it.
Here's two things. One is this sort of revisits the discussion that we had about linguistics, where like, what is the definition of a term? Like the word to kill, you know, certainly the prototypical Platonic ideal of killing is not standing by, not pulling a lever while five people die. Like an argument could be made that that's not the definition of killing. Letting die, absolutely. Whereas, you know, of course, there's, it's not just as simple as like, what is the definition? What does the word mean? What am I going to do? But the other thing is, I have a personal experience of like, you're familiar with the, oh, what is the fly? There's like this insect that like people are like, you have to kill this insect because it's very harmful.
Let's say it's like an invasive species.
I had it in my head, but whatever it is, like it has a very clear look. And they're like in New York City, especially recently I learned about it, you know, in the past year or so, they're like, you got to kill this because it'll be much more beneficial to the world, to the environment, to the society, to us. And it's hard for me to do that. It's not that like a divine being is telling me don't kill, but I'm like, I don't want to, you know. I'm not sure what the exact circumstances are like of each one that, but yeah, I do my best not to kill any creature, any insect, any anything if I can avoid it. Life in this paradigm, like it is, seems so far for the most part, for most people, for most beings, impossible to avoid suffering or causing suffering in some ways, but we can do our best.
Yeah. No, I totally agree with that too. So, okay. I think we exhausted the trolley problem.
Yes.
The next one, it's a classic one. It's Theseus's ship.
Oh yeah. Big
so, you know, you have a ship, Theseus's ship, right? And, you know, over time you have things being replaced. Let's say it's
a plank,
you know, plank by plank or, you know, piece by piece. And it ends up that it's totally replaced.
And it's while it's all out to sea, like while you're out to sea, you replace one plank and you're like, well, that's still Theseus's ship. And you replace another. And eventually every plank is replaced. And then you're like, but every step of the way, it was still Theseus's ship. It's just one plank different from the one before.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you feel about that? Is it actually Theseus's ship, or is this another like play on words and we have to use linguistics?
Great question. I mean, spoiler alert, the answer is going to be yes. But here's just to conclude, the way that I've heard it is that that ship, the new ship, comes back to land and they're like, here's Theseus's ship. Then they take all the planks that were the original ship that they had, and then they built a new ship out of it. And they're like, now that's the original planks. And they're like, wait, but which one is Theseus's ship? Is it this one? Is it that one?
Oh, okay. Okay.
And so I think that, I mean, I'll look to linguistics, but I'll also look to Buddhism here, where the thing that is true of everything, the largest category in Buddhism is the selfless, the things that lack a self, the things that lack a inherent, permanent, unchanging, ultimate self. That is everything. Nothing has an unchanging, permanent self in the Buddhist paradigm. And it makes sense to me that like ourselves, like in physics, you know, the molecules of our existence, like the quarks, the electrons and everything, they are constantly disappearing and reappearing and being replaced. And so like from moment to moment, we are not made of identical matter. You know, colloquially, you're you, I'm me, your name is your name, my name is my name. We're all a Theseus's ship, but the baby that we were like is made of completely different cells, completely different matter, and also completely different memory experiences. Like unless you remember every moment of your life, like most of us don't remember being born. Most of us don't remember, like I don't have a lot of memories before the age of 2 or 3, and then it's very sparing. Have you heard this thing? They say the same person cannot step into the same river twice because like, what does it mean to be the same river? Obviously, the water that's rushing by now is not the water that rushed by a moment ago. Like, the Nile is the Nile. The Amazon is the Amazon. But also, the water is completely different all of the time. So what does it mean to be the same river? And that we are those as well. We're a completely different set of atoms. even the planet, you know, we're like, oh, at least the Earth is the same, right? Like the planet is changing. We're in a different location than we've ever been in, you know, relative to where we were. The solar system, the galaxy is hurtling through the cosmos, you know. Back to linguistics, the question of, is it the same ship? Is it Theseus's ship? Is context dependent and definition dependent? I remember when I first heard about like the chicken or the egg, like which came first? And I'm like, well, probably the egg, because dinosaurs were around before the chicken and dinosaurs laid eggs. And so definitely there was an egg before there was a chicken. And people are like, no, no, no. Okay. But the question is like, is it the chicken egg or the chicken? So now not a dinosaur egg, a chicken egg or a chicken that came first? And I'm like, well, then it really depends on the definition of a chicken egg. Is a chicken egg an egg that a chicken comes out of, or an egg that comes out of a chicken? Because for the most part, those are the same, but go back enough along the spectrum of dinosaur evolution to chicken, let's say, at which point is it a chicken? And at which point is it a dinosaur? And so that at that point, did a dinosaur lay an egg that a chicken came out of? And is that egg a dinosaur egg or a chicken egg? And then there's your answer. I mean, it's like Zen koans. They can't be answered literally, objectively, in some universal framework, because no such framework exists.
Yeah, that's fair. The chicken or the egg question, actually, it gets on my nerves a little bit, because there's a little like, it's like, okay, let's actually get into the weeds if you want to have a real answer here. Because, you know, I can literally just say to you now, it's like, well, chickens are technically dinosaurs. They're descendants of theropod dinosaurs. So it's like, well, technically, yes.
That's so. And also, you could argue then a chicken is a dinosaur, but is a dinosaur a chicken, or is it a, you know, square rectangle set subset relationship? Like,
it's a subset relationship.
Yes. Yeah. There are dinosaurs that weren't chickens. So right. The same way that we can say, you know, we're animals, but when we say humans and animals, we really mean humans and other animals. So we could say chickens are dinosaurs, but when we talk about chickens, we're like chickens and non-chicken dinosaurs.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah, or non-dinosaur chickens. Yeah,
that's exactly why we have taxonomy, to try to sort through this garbage. Because if not, it's like, oh man, it would be very frustrating.
Absolutely. I mean, in Buddhism, the concept of something being the same, like there's by definition, they would say that something is the same if it is the same object and has the same name. So like, even if there was something that could be called two different things, like, you know, Mike and Mr. Kaplan, they would say, is Mike the same entity, the same phenomenon as Mr. Kaplan? The answer would be no. We're mutually exclusive phenomena. You know, we refer to the same object, but in order for it to be technically the same, it has to be Mike is the same as Mike. Mr. Kaplan is the same as Mr. Kaplan. And then that gets us into the same, you know, river shenanigans that we had before by practical usage. We're like, yeah, I'm Mike. I was Mike a second ago. I'll be Mike in a second. But there's no one thing that we can point at across time and space to be like, yes, this Mike, always Mike.
Mm-hmm. Microscopically, it's like, well, no. But like macroscopically, yeah, Mike, you're Mike. You know, you're not changing, but... Which makes a little sense. Again, the thought of experiments is fun. Have we wasted a lot of time on it?
Again, what else are you up to? Yeah.
So the last one.
Yes.
Baby Hitler. Run me through it.
The question is, if you could go back in time and kill Hitler when he was a baby. I mean, it's kind of the trolley problem again. You know, right now, 6 million Jews and, you know, various, you know, queer people and disabled people and
gypsies and the Roma
people. Yeah. Various. Yeah. All the people that were murdered because of the Holocaust, because of Hitler, they're on one side of the trolley path. And what do you want to turn the crank and head down the one where it's just running over a baby that is Hitler? Which, you know, the question, of course, is like, do you want to kill a baby? To everyone around there, they'd be like, whoa, you just killed a baby. It's such an interesting question that why leap to murdering the baby as opposed to like kidnapping the baby and raising it better, you know, like,
yeah.
And of course also he like sort of disregards all of the other factors beyond Hitler as an individual, like that were going on societally in Germany at the time that made possible the rise of a dictator as such. Short answer is it's just the trolley problem again. So whatever you say for the trolley problem, it's actually way more people on the line. And the answer always ends up being like, well, glad time travel doesn't exist because this would really throw things out of whack.
Yeah, most definitely. And off the air, you know, like talking to different people, it's always fun to hear these answers because, you know, it's like, oh, well, then I guess you kind of resonate with that school of thought. That's neat. I didn't know that about you. Cool.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah. These are obviously like extreme examples, but then like once you know somebody's kind of school of thought, then you could kind of like predict what they might do in a certain circumstance wherever there's like a moral conflict.
Yeah. And here's something that I never thought of until right now. So I don't think I need to tell this old joke, but there's this sex worker shaming joke where it's like somebody says to a person, would you have sex with me for $1 billion? And the person says, yes, I would. And then they say, would you have sex with me for $1? And then they say, who do you think I am? And then, or what do you think I am? And then they say, well, we've already established that. Now we're just haggling for a price. And like, I didn't put any genders in it, but, you know, historically it's been sexist. It's been anti, you know, sex worker in a way that I disagree with. But I feel like conceptually that points to the idea that obviously things don't operate the same way on the small scale as they do on the big scale. The big scale and the small scale are different, which, and so the analogy that I thought of just right now is like, oh yeah, like Newtonian versus quantum physics. Like, you know, literally like on the smallest scale, like Newtonian physics don't work the same way they do on the large scale, and quantum physics doesn't work on the large scale. That's not like a gotcha moment, be like, aha, so which one is it? You gotta be just one physics. And like, oh yeah, maybe it makes sense that one set of rules work for large things and one set of rules work for small things. And then where does it switch over? Maybe that's an interesting question. Because these are extreme circumstances, these like, would you kill baby Hitler or would you kill a person right in front of you under these circumstances? Like, maybe sadly, they don't tell us as much about who we are and how we would live and how we think a society should work in the non-extraordinary, non-extreme case, because we know what we do in those extreme cases, but do those actually teach us what we would do? I mean, good thought experiments to think about, like, well, what would I do in life if a child is drowning in front of me, or if somebody is asking me for $1 because they need money? And a quick thing, I just saw a study that the unhoused in some city were given some thousands of dollars. And like the worry that people always have stereotypically when they're like, they're just going to use it to buy drugs or alcohol or, and the good news is in this actual real life experiment, they bought housing, they paid for vehicles, they, you know, they bought food, they paid for the things that we would all want to use our money to live our lives. So it is nice to be able to do some like real world, ethical, philosophical examination as well.
Are you an athlete who is constantly on the grind? Maybe you're a student who's cramming for an 8 a.m. exam the next day. Or maybe you're someone who's crushing a hike and you have three peaks to go. Well, you've come to the right ad. Sigma snacks are a healthy alternative to pre-workout and energy drinks. These snacks deliver easily digestible sugars and carbs necessary to crush an early morning workout, late night study sesh, or any adventure in between. By combining caffeine and the amino acid L-theanine, these bars are backed by scientific research to provide clean energy, extra focus, and reduce the anxiety and crash that are associated with normal pre-workout and junk energy drinks. Not to mention, they taste great. Specifically, I have been taking them with me on my backpacking adventures. They're a great way to start the day without having any jitters or an upset stomach on the trail. Lastly, Sigma Snacks is a student-run, student-operated startup that would like to offer you 15% off your first purchase with the promo code STEAM. So head on over to eatsigmasnacks.com and order your first Sigma snack today to have the best and most reliable source of energy shipped right to your door. That's eatsigmasnacks.com, promo code STEAM for energy that's out of this world.
I think we're wrapping up here on the philosophy of ethics and talking about our open-ended dilemmas. And the last one that I think would be fun is the talk about determinism versus free will. And I feel like we shouldn't have to define that. I feel like everybody is familiar with that. So what are your thoughts. What camp do you sit in? And feel free to be devil's advocate or feel free to give the counter arguments too.
I'll be the angel's advocate. Devil's advocate. Why do we need the devil to advocate or an advocate for the devil? But I'll say three specific things. Number one, who am I? I am but one human being in this moment. And I am not an authority. I do not have all of the information in the universe. But it seems to me, based on what I've seen, read, and experienced, that if I had to pick a binary, which maybe I don't, maybe this is another spectrum from determinism to free will. But if given the choice of there is free will or there is not free will, I think that there is not free will, but it pays for us to act as though there is free will, because if you just like, no free will, so it doesn't matter what I do, so I'm just going to do nothing, then you're fated to do nothing. Whereas if you're like, who knows whether I'm fated to or not, and especially because I don't know and you don't know, if anyone knows, let us know. But, you know, do the things that make sense to do, that feel good to do, that are fulfilling, that are enjoyable. If at the end of your life you find out you're like, you were just fated, you were just destined to do all those things, well, then good. Then you picked a good destiny, or destiny picked a good you. One of the reasons that I think this is, you know, in Buddhism, another sort of aspect of it is that all phenomena are the effect of some cause, that there's causes and conditions. You can sort of zoom in or zoom out as much as you want. Like, you know, we are caused by our parents in some way, but also we, like the version of ourselves that exists right now is caused by the version of ourselves from a moment ago, from a day ago, from the choices and thoughts that we had and made yesterday and last week, and go back as far as you can. So you can always, like, you know, a pot is caused by a potter and clay. And so you can, you know, zoom in as granularly as you wish, you know, to the moment, or you can zoom out and be like, oh yeah, so, you know, life on Earth was caused by the Big Bang at some point, you know, with some other intermediary causes along the way. But if you get really granular about it, you know, if you keep going back far enough, and this actually will get into ethics as well. In one of the first ethics classes I took in college, one day we talked about a killer, a real life murderer, who killed two people and just sat there in the car with these two dead people eating their lunch until the police arrived and brought him to jail. He seemed heartless. He seemed like a sociopath, a psychopath. And we were like, wow, like, should this person, you know, be put to death? What should happen? Like, what's going on? Isn't this the worst kind of person that you can imagine? And like, then the next day we discussed a different scenario where there had been a father of several who, his wife was pregnant and he didn't think that it was his own baby. And so he like shunned her and like abused her. And like, you know, I think the baby was born premature because he like kicked her in her stomach. And it was like this horrendous thing. And like, and that baby, because he thought it wasn't his, he was like, if anyone touches that baby, like I beat them or I kill them. And like, he would sometimes like, legitimately, this is like just a true story that I remember, where he would like get his gun and just be like, everyone out in 30 seconds or I start shooting. And this baby grew up, you know, without the care that it needed, without physical touch, without love. And we're like, wow, what a horrible thing, like the worst thing that could happen to that baby. And then we find out that baby is who grew up into the killer from the day before. And so when does moral responsibility kick into gear? We're like, if we were born in those circumstances, we would have been that baby. We would have been that person. Like, when did the baby have any choice? When did that person, when he turned 18, you know, like, it's such an arbitrary thing. Like, we didn't talk about the heap paradox, but, you know, things add up and like, we're like, eventually it's a heap, but when did it become a heap? When did we become a morally responsible individual? And I'm not saying that we shouldn't say that we are morally responsible individuals, like living in a society, it makes sense. I mean, the practical question of like, what do we do when a person turns out like that? But you can trace it back all the way. The killer turned out that way in large part due to how he was parented or not parented, how the circumstances of his nature and non-nurture. And then the father, similarly, the father that way as well. Like, there's a Buddhist sage called Shantideva. He said something like, if somebody hits us with a stick, we don't get mad at the stick, or it's not reasonable to get mad at the stick, because the stick is just like a tool, an agent by which we are being hit. And he says, furthermore, the person is kind of like the stick as well. the person is also like the victim of circumstances, the victim of like this delusion that we're all under. And he's like, if you're going to be mad at anything, be mad at the delusion. And the delusion of the person who's hitting you with the stick is probably even greater than the person who's getting hit with the stick. Of course, try to get away from the person. Try to avoid the person getting hit with the stick. Try to help people so that they don't end up hitting people with sticks or murdering people. But the point is that you go back far enough, is there a point that you could point at and be like, ah, that's where I became, you know, in control of my life, my faculties, my consciousness, my whatever. And like, of course, it's maybe a like a greater or lesser thing, like, you know, a sandwichier thing that as an adult, I certainly have at least more semblance of control over my behavior, over my actions, over my, but I'm not really in charge in any moment of like everything is based on like the Rube Goldberg machine of atoms smashing together, of neurons firing, to point to a place and be like, that's where it started. That's where free will began. Like maybe the way to free will, if you want to say that there is free will, is to say, maybe I you know, gave the instrumentation of my own theory's demise in saying like, well, maybe at very small, the very small numbers thing, very small is different than very large. And once you are large, maybe there is something that operates differently than at the small scale. Maybe, you know, maybe an adult is different than a baby, I guess is what I'm saying. But I don't know when or where or how to parse it to point. So that's why determinism makes a lot of sense to me. But also, it makes a lot of sense to not think of it. So the third aspect of what I'm going to share is that, is there fate? Do you ever watch The Price is Right?
Yes, I have in my life. Yeah.
Bob Barker, rest in peace. Do you know the game Plinko?
I've heard of it, yeah. So I've never watched it, but
the way Plinko exists is there's these like discs, and there's kind of like a board of pegs. At the bottom, there are like these different slots where the disc can end up after bouncing off all of the pegs in a way that seems like it would be, it's impossible to, you know, know it from where you start it. You're like, you try to get it into like the highest money, but if you do it and it gets there and you try to do it again, you know, the slightest alternate factor will bring it to a complete other side of the thing. That is sort of a great exemplification of the way that like in my life, that fate works, that fate exists looking backwards. Be like, oh, I know exactly how that got here. Looking forwards, act like there's free will. Looking backwards, act like, well, this is the only thing that did happen. So it's the only thing that really could have happened based on all of the scientific forces, all of the gravity, all of, you know, everything in the universe led to this Plinko chip going exactly here to where it is. And like, it's like that with my career also. Like, how do you become a comedian? I'm like, well, for me, I started out in Boston in 2002, and then in 2006, I went to Seattle and did a competition there where I met somebody who invited me to another festival the next year where a college booking agent saw me. And by that point, I'd had an hour of material that I was like, I'd love to perform it at colleges. And they're like, we'll book you. And then I got into this conference that you apply to called NACA, and you show up and then you perform for all of these. It's very competitive to get into it because you perform for 100 different schools maybe, and if you do well, then maybe they book you. And maybe I booked like 10 or 20 schools, and then I could pay my rent for a certain amount of time and not have to do the job where I was working at the linguistics department anymore, which I love doing, but I was happy to make more at a college than I was in several weeks of work at that job. And getting to do the thing that I loved. So I'm like, I can look back at the Plinko chip of my career and be like, I understand exactly how I got to where I was. But for anyone else to try to replicate that exactly, be like, yeah, I mean, you could try to be like, oh yeah, like go to open mics, like write, perform, watch, read, live a life worth commenting on and considering, take in the art that you want. And so I think that my final answer, determinism and fate backwards and free will, or at least the possibility of it, the hope for it, the positive results of believing those things moving forward.
Okay, that's really fair. I mean, you probably stated everything that I was going to state. Just, you know, you had a lot of great analogies and stories there. One quick thing that I think to really summarize everything that you said is that, you know, chaos does exist, and chaos is deterministic. Our brains are chaotic. Our life is chaotic. Things are chaotic, but it's still deterministic. The only time where you get rebuttal from anybody that is in the free will camp that wants to say, well, this isn't deterministic, is like some aspects of quantum mechanics. And it's like, yes, but it's random. Like there's a will happening, right? That's the one thing that bothers me the most from the foundations of quantum mechanics with like Everettian versus Copenhagen. And Copenhagen is like, well, there's an agent. You have to have, you have to measure it. An agent has to do the measuring. And it's like, no, that's not really how that works. But like, it's, yeah, we're not getting into that. But the fact is that quantum mechanics isn't a willed thing. It is a either a determined or a random thing. That's a different way of going at it than say that it's willed.
Yeah, and I'll just add that on the tiniest level, it obviously operates differently than on like the human level, where I don't know if you've read the book by Dan Ariely called Predictably Irrational. It's all about how human behavior is irrational, but often in predictable ways. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there is some hope for us if we, you know, examine it enough.
Yeah. And another thing that we should probably talk about is that, you know, you said like, you know, there's nothing wrong with having the thought that free will does exist and whether it does or it doesn't, you know, we should still live our lives, whether it was or it wasn't. The evidence, the scientific evidence points towards one more than the other. But at the same time, the scientific evidence doesn't really take into account the emotional aspect of the individual. And so sometimes that can lead to, you know, a fatalistic worldview. And that's not what we want, right? Whenever we say like, oh, things are deterministic, you know, we don't want you to become fatalistic. That's not what we want here. So definitely, you know, there's nothing wrong with feeling like you have control in your life in some aspect. However, if you, you know, want to go about it in a more sciencey route, the way that at least our brain works from kind of what we understand is exactly how you explained it, where you have the genetic aspect and also the social implications that like build our brain, right? And, you know, when you're going throughout life and you're having these experiences and stuff, you know, your brain is storing this information such that whenever a decision has to be made, you know, on the macroscopic level, your brain has, you know, a category of ways to respond. And if you feel like without free will, there is no optimism, there's no way in which I can have good change, that's not true, because your brain has many different ways, many different things stored that can respond to an optimistic stimuli, which can result in good change. So to say that there is no way that you're going to have good change and nothing's going to benefit you is not true.
Yeah. And I'll add a less sciencey offering that I think that this will, the thing that I'm about to say, I think is utilitarian in that I think it will hopefully bring joy to more people than otherwise. And also, I think that it, on a Kantian level, I would will everyone to feel this way as well. I would say that it feels like I am choosing to believe that there is determinism. But on the other hand, I feel like I can't help but believe that there is free will.
That's fair.
I mean, and if you believe in free will, but there is no free will, well, then you have no choice. So just keep believing it.
Yeah, exactly. I agree with that too. So I was expecting more of a debate on that, but I'm glad. I'm glad we don't have to debate. It's good that we align on that aspect. Mike, it has been fantastic to have you on the podcast. We've talked about so much. This is great. You know, I got to learn a lot, and I'm sure whoever's watching or listening definitely learned a lot from this, from linguistics to different aspects in philosophy, and maybe took away a different worldview. Who knows? So thanks for being on the podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I had a great time.
Cheers. That is all for this episode of Everything STEAM. I just wanted to take a quick second and thank Mike for sharing his knowledge and expertise on linguistics, philosophy, history, and everything else that we discussed in the podcast. If you want to see more of Mike's content, just head to our website, everythingsteam.org, go to this episode's page, and connect with Mike via that way, or you can just look up Mike Kaplan anywhere on social media. He's literally all over the place, and he makes amazing content. I would also love to mention my amazing team for their collective efforts to make this show happen. This podcast was edited by Ariel Piermont. The clips that you'll see on social media were created by our intern, Molly Chakery, and our episode art was created by Gabrielle Edmiston. After the episode, please give our podcast a rating and review on whatever platform you get your podcasts on. We're always looking for feedback, and the rating would greatly help us out in the fight against those algorithms. Lastly, be sure to check us out on all the socials for podcast news, upcoming episodes, and just fun Steam content. Just search Everything Steam on Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook to join in on the fun. Once again, thank you for listening to Everything Steam. I'm your host, Sam Stanford. And as always, stay curious.